track session number 12502, reel 16.
Field Marshal Bramall, reel 16.
To the question, you know, why have you dug in here? Because the field of fire is so marvellous. And then I would say, but what is the range of your weapons? And they'd say, well, 600, 700 yards, perhaps at the most. So I'd say, well, what's the point of seeing 3 miles if you can only shoot 600 or 700 yards? You will be destroyed before you have a chance of using your weapons. You want the lightest forces to give you early warning, and you want to be where you're concealed, and the enemy don't see you until you're prepared to take them on. And it was these sort of things. And then they used to look at me as if I was completely mad. They couldn't think what I was talking about.
You said that you also encountered the Territorial Army in extenso for the first time. What did you make of them? Did you find them...
Well, I think it was at the time, I don't know if it was my concept, but I certainly implemented it, the question of the one army concept, really, trying to bring the territorials in into the whole regular thing. So they weren't a thing of the past. They weren't a force apart.
To integrate them.
Integrate them. Of course, Territorial Army had a checkered career because, of course, in the First World War, Kitchener refused to use the very good Territorial Army divisions that Haldane had built up. And he thought they were a lot of playboys, and that so he ground them, so to speak, and formed his new army divisions, which took quite a long time. Well, we were determined, of course, to integrate the territorial battalions into the British Army of the Rhine set-up. And so I think I did a lot, and I learnt a lot about what makes the territorials tick, and what they needed in the way of facilities and money for manned training days, and made them feel part of the show, I think.
Did you find them more or less resistant to your ideas about tactics than the regulars?
Well, I think perhaps they were less sure of themselves, so perhaps they were prepared to listen to new ideas and felt that there was the regulars somehow. Where it had come from, I can't think, because I'd been a teacher at the School of Infantry in my younger day. Where it had come from, I don't know. But it was quite incredible that that is where they would always position themselves.
It has been said that the TA was extremely varied in its standards of training and achievement. Did you find that, or were they...
Yes, you see, I have a theory about the TA, which is, I think, even now in my retirement, I'm beginning to get over to the territorials, is that I think the biggest mistake, I understand why it happened, but the biggest mistake was when we went away from the business of territorial army companies being grafted onto regular battalions as the fourth company. First of all, as I've explained, every regular battalion needs a fourth company, and yet there is never the manpower to go round. Secondly is that a territorial army company is indistinguishable from a regular company after the very shortest period of training. A territorial army battalion is very distinguishable for a regular battalion after a very long period of training. This is because all the complicated things like deployment drills and radio communications and support weapons and things like that are not done nearly as well because they haven't had the time in the territories now and the regulars. And I think it was a great pity, and I hope maybe we will get back to this now, that the territorials are used for grafting on. I mean, you could have sent a territorial army company to the Gulf, for instance, and grafted on to the Staffords, who, even though they were made up to 800 men, never actually had a fourth rifle company. I think you can do much more in this respect. And so I think that the territorials were very good when they were dealing with very low-level tactics at infantry. Sort of the company level. They weren't quite so good when they had to compare with a regular battalion for quick deployment and radio communications and so on.
When you became Vice Chief General Staff for
Vice Chief of the Defence Staff.
Vice Chief of Defence Staff, not of the General Staff. Mm.
There was still a Vice Chief of the General Staff, but I became Vice Chief of the Defence Staff as a four-star, the first time that there had ever been a Commander-in-Chief coming in as the Vice Chief of Defence Staff. Up to that time, Vice Chief of Defence Staff had been a three-star officer, but this was the first time one had a four-star officer as the Vice Chief of Defence Staff.
And your sphere here was personnel and logistics.
Yes, and my big thing was getting the forces pay right. This was the very big task that I had, because the forces pay at that stage, and we're talking about 1978, the forces pay had dropped to 37% behind comparable skills and responsibilities outside. And this was because of a series of pay freezes and pay awards which hadn't been fully met. The Labour government were just beginning to realise that they had to do something about that. Although it was becoming the end of their time, of course, Callaghan lost the election in early 79. But towards the end, he realised that they had to do something about the NATO 3% growth, and they had to do something about forces pay. And so my great job was to try to make sure that they didn't get off this hook and met this commitment and producing all the facts and figures, and we did achieve it, of course. We achieved it with an agreement that the whole 37.5% would be made up, but would be paid in two stages. And then, of course, when Mrs. Thatcher came in 79, she paid the second stage straight away. So we did it, but it was quite a battle. And I had to do a certain amount of discreet lobbying outside to achieve what we wanted to do.
I can remember that at the time there were stories in the press about soldiers living on family income supplement.
Well, there certainly were, and of course there were no pilots in the cockpit. This was the other thing. I mean, we were losing a tremendous drain on our... People were leaving the forces right, left and centre. We were very under strength. The PVR rate was enormous, and it was absolutely criminal the way they'd let the pay go down. And this is because we'd been lumped in, you see, with the public service, and the public service had had pay freeze after pay freeze. And nothing that the Armed Forces Pay Review Body would do, who were completely in the pocket of the Treasury, was able to break it.
This is always a problem with pilots, though, isn't it, in every air force worldwide, that because the opportunities in civil aviation are so much more lucrative and less dangerous, pilots tend to... Mm. Do their training in the Air Force, serve out their minimum engagement and then leave.
And, of course, there was quite full employment going on at the time. And inflation was high, but employment was low.
Were you losing any other particular type of man besides the pilot?
Oh, yes, we were losing all the skilled men. This was another trouble. All the REME officers and the REME staff sergeants, the REME sergeant majors were all getting wonderful jobs in Plessis and places like that. It was a very, very serious thing indeed. And I was empowered to do some discreet press briefing. And I succeeded because what was happening was that Mully, who at his heart was absolutely in the right place, wanted to give the forces this money. And I think the Prime Minister did. But the civil service bureaucracy and the Treasury was so keen on not breaking the pay freeze and not setting a precedent that they were prepared to write for the Cabinet all sorts of documents, which in fact didn't achieve this for the armed forces at all. And the chiefs of staff were very anxious that public opinion, which was entirely on the forces' side, would make itself felt so that the Cabinet could override this. Now, this is where, you know, one is treading on very dangerous ground on how much it is legitimate. We were acting, to some extent, as trade union leaders at the time, which is, you know, not what one is supposed to do, but of course there was no trade union fighting for the armed forces at all. So I was empowered to talk to sympathetic journalists, and the one result was we had a marvellous article, leader in the Times, called The Queen Shilling, which was a very, very supportive article indeed, powerful, number one article. And then I got slightly trapped. I mean, I don't regret it, but it wasn't exactly what I intended. But there's a thing called the Press Association. And there's a marvellous reporter there, I forget his name, but he has a beard like yourself. And I found myself with him, and I thought they were sort of background people. And I was a bit naive about this, and I gave him some figures. They weren't secret figures, but they were figures about pilots and everything else. And they'd all been at one time or another known, but I gave them to him all at once.
Consolidated.
And they were consolidated figures, giving him, I thought, background. And they appeared on the ticker tape, all these figures, about half an hour before Jim Callaghan was to get up in the House of Commons to make a statement. And, of course, he was very relaxed about it, but the Tories, thinking that they would wanted to get at the government, said that this was absolutely monstrous. What was he doing about it, you see? And then it was all said these figures had been leaked improperly, and they then had a great witch hunt, and who was responsible for this terrible leaking? And the government, Callaghan was then forced to say there'd been mischief makers in the Ministry of Defence and so on. And so it was a very, very awkward time, and they wanted to find out how it had happened, who had given it away, and so on. And eventually, there was so much pressure, the chiefs of staff said it was their collective responsibility that I'd been authorised to do this thing. And we got our money, which I honestly don't think we would have done, and the headline came out, Jim gives forces their paving. But I think it was the only way to defeat the bureaucracy, which was forcing the government into other fields. But it is one of these things, I deal with it in quite length in one's book, because this is the sort of conduct which from time to time chiefs of staff have reverted to. Jackie Fisher used to do it the whole time, Beattie used to do it the whole time, Monty used to do it the whole time, Trenchard. Mountbatten, of course, was a past master at it, but it is not a thing that endears chiefs of staff to ministers, because they are reckoned to be betraying their trust as speechless public servants, and it is what makes ministers go to much more discreet civil service to get advice, because they're terrified that if they go to the service people will lobby. It's a very, very nice distinction. But, of course, if the service people never lobby, they lose out quite a number of times. So it was an incident which I have mixed feelings about. I think we had to do it. I wouldn't have actually done it in that particular way. I mean, I was thinking I was giving a background briefing. I wouldn't have wanted to embarrass the Prime Minister just as he was getting on his feet. But I would have wanted to get that information through to the Prime Minister in some way so that he could have taken a formal decision.
Of course, this is the difficulty in a participatory democracy where one element is forbidden to participate, isn't it?
Well, that's right. And I mean, I think we, you know, it is why Options for Change and the Heseltine reorganisation was done by such a tiny little tight group. Because they were always afraid that somehow service people would be able to sway public opinion, and they wouldn't be able to do what they, or in some cases the Treasury, wanted them to do.
One might argue it would be healthier if, in fact, military personnel were allowed to take an open part in political
well,
life.
Well, where I have no conscience, but my goodness me, it's unpopular, is if one is summoned before the House of Commons Defence Select Committee. And the obstacles that the civil service place in your way if you go there is absolutely enormous. But isn't they can't now because I'm retired. But when I was chief of the general staff, you were greatly restricted from saying the truth.
But your loyalty, presumably, is to the state rather than to the government.
This is a very good argument. I mean, your loyalty is to.
And ultimately, your own conscience.
No, you see, your loyalty, that's the trouble. Well, you can say your loyalty is to your own conscience, but you see, your loyalty is to the Queen. But the Queen is only head of state. The Queen is represented by Parliament and her ministers. And you are therefore responsible to the ministers for, within reason. As long as the Queen has opened Parliament and given authority to Parliament and her ministers, you are responsible to the Queen through her ministers. And this is cropped up with the Dardanelles campaign, that Jackie Fisher, who didn't like the Dardanelles campaign, felt that he couldn't vote against it because his Secretary of State, Winston Churchill, was saying something different, and he was not a full member of the Dardanelles Committee, only an co-opted member.
But then, if a case arises where your conscience tells you that there's a conflict in your loyalties because the Queen's ministers are not being straight...
Well, you see, in a democracy, it is not the will... I mean, you can have an opinion, but it is the will of the people, as represented in their elected parliament.
But if they're not given full information, how can they make their decision on who to elect in a competent manner?
Well, they are. People would say they were being given full information, but they weren't having that extra element which makes politicians come down on one side or another, and that is the emphasis of public opinion. That's the trouble.
It seems that the problem with the Defence Committee is that if senior officers are not allowed to tell the whole truth about controversial matters,
because
the officer gets
in the way. I think this is worried. And of course, in this particular case, we had a even greater thing because we'd asked to see Callaghan as a body, the Chiefs of Staff, and he, on grounds that it wasn't convenient, had refused to see us. Or refused to see the Chiefs of Staff. I mean, I was a servant of the Chiefs of Staff, but had refused to see the Chiefs of Staff. And we knew inexorably what was happening. They would be forced to have accepted this paper, writing down the services case so as not to bait the pay freeze, which had been prepared by the civil servants and the Treasury, of course. So I think we got by. Mallet thought we lost 0.5% or 1% on the pay because of what we'd done. And I must just show you something because it's worth... We couldn't do anything else, but as I say, we could have done it. It wasn't as subtle as I would have liked. The first thing was utterly subtle. But this business of the all these facts and figures coming out all at once, looking as if there'd been a leak at a time very embarrassing for the Prime Minister. I don't think I'd have actually had the nerve to have done that consciously. It happened fortuitously. It may have been the telling point, but... That was the biggest thing on the personnel side, and then, of course, I got tremendously involved in this question of trying to get housing right for services, and I think it was my biggest regret in all my service that I never achieved, it wasn't for want of trying, a proper house purchase scheme for the services. And of course it's been resurrected now, 10 years later, not a very adequate one, but the result was that since then you've had an appalling record of absence of homeowners amongst particularly the army, and a number of people finding themselves homeless when they leave the service, occupying illegally married quarters because they've got nowhere else to go, and finding it extremely difficult to get on local authority housing lists. But we, 10 years ago when I was VCDSPNL, we fought very, very hard to get a proper housing scheme, but it always faltered at the last minute. And of course I began to see, I was just about, of course, to take over as CGS, but of course we suddenly saw this extraordinary paradox of Mrs. Thatcher and the Conservatives coming in on the crest of a defence wave, really, putting the fence forces right, doing all the things that the Labour Party had neglected, with high expectations of what was going to be done, and then suddenly seeing the conflict between being strong on defence and being tough monetarists. And this, of course, almost immediately, and didn't really recover till the Falklands campaign, produced an enormous clash. And I always say to people, this is an extraordinary thing, because the Conservatives are strong on defence. They believe in defence. They don't like having defence reviews, and if they do, they call them something else. But they are tough monetarists, and there is not much money sloshing around in Whitehall. And what is bad for the goose is bad for the gander. There's no money sloshing around on Whitehall, so there's not enough money for defence to meet the commitments that they always want to have, being by nature imperialists or interveners or living up to your responsibilities or whatever. Now, the Labour Party are, in quote, weak on defence. They have to appease a left wing who are not very interested in defence. And they always slightly give the impression that they would prefer not to have any defence at all if they get away with it. At the same time, they are not tight monetarists. There's a lot of money slushing around in Whitehall. And what is good for the goose is good for the gander. And therefore there is more money to meet the commitments they've undertaken, which are probably less than the Conservatives. And the match of resources to commitments is usually better under Labour than it is under Conservatives.
Another point about the Labour Party is that, on the whole, when out of office, they attack the nuclear forces. They're a favourite target, which means that they have to make some sort of commensurate commitment to reinforce the conventional forces. When they get into office, they find that they can put a little more money into the conventional forces, but they can't generally get the manpower, so that it is spread a bit more thickly.
Mm. Yes, I mean, I suppose that, I mean, these things may change in future, but on the whole, the military man feels slightly unwanted under a Labour administration, just as a school teacher tends to feel unwanted under a Tory administration. And as I say, these things may change in future, but this has been so up to now. So there is a reluctance, perhaps, for people to go into the armed forces, and they need very good pay and conditions to make sure they're in. But as far as commitments and resources together, those are usually better matched, because they don't take on more commitments. They discourage extra commitments. You don't get this tremendous discrepancy which we were finding in the 79 and 80, 81.
Now, you're also responsible, I think, for logistics. Did you have any major concerns there?
Well, I can't think of any tremendous issue, but I chaired, as VCDSPNL, I chaired the PPO's committee, the Principal Personnel Officers Committee, and then we were very much talking about pay, and the Principal Administrative Officers. In fact, it was PPO's, PAO's, both together, and the head doctors and the head nurses. I chaired all those committees. And I suppose that the big issue on logistics was to try to rationalise the logistics system and the agencies in amongst the three services, really, trying to see that you didn't have naval hospitals only looking after naval people, Air Force hospitals only after air people, and trying to make departments responsible for transport or spare parts, trying to rationalise the whole thing in order to see there was not overlap and waste.
Was this the era when... Was it the Admiralty who was made responsible for catering?
Yes, that sort of thing. And somebody for transport. I can't remember all of them, but this was exactly the sort of thing. That,
presumably, if it were ever decided that you needed to go towards the legendary Stage 3, then you could take a step towards it by amalgamating such things as the military, naval and air nursing and medical services.
Yes, I think you... yes, oh, certainly you could. I mean, I'm not sure you couldn't do more now, but you see, one of the arguments is that there isn't... that every corps has a parent department. And if you had a chaplain's department, you'd have to... or of doctors or whatever it is, you'd have to put it... There is no... central department. There is a Ministry of Defence, but there is no central department. And you'd have to put it under, you'd have to make all the chaplains responsibility of, say, the Navy Department. All the doctors responsibility of the Army Department. And this, of course, produces absolutely appalling points. And I remember when I was in Hong Kong, wanting to make sure that the practices worked for everybody. You had a joint practice in Tamar, GP practice. Your hospital served everybody. And I remember saying to my head doctor, why don't we put some Royal Air Force nurses in the hospital, the Army Hospital in Kowloon? Oh, he said, Matron would never stand for that. So I said, why not? They're women, aren't they? He said, I don't think she'd even agree on that. She's... But I think, in a sense, more can be done on this if, there are the people who say, well, RAF medicine's very specialised. But my feeling that you or I, who can always go to these, we don't actually mind who takes our teeth out or operates on us or gives us a medical check-up, as long as they know what they're doing.
Well, it's certainly true that some aspects of aviation medicine are very specialised, but that would apply only to a very small proportion of the Royal Air Force as a whole, wouldn't it? With only a small number of them are actually aircrew.
But, of course, naval doctors have got to be prepared to go to sea, of course, and army doctors to put up camouflage nets and so on like that. But, what one tries to do is to see that, for instance, the hospitals are rationalised and Rorton serves one bit of the country and Woolwich serves another bit of the country and Gibraltar does all the troops. And, So that is the way it's been done. Whether you could get even more efficiency by going further, I don't know.
Do you think that one obstacle that might be that the three services have different systems of personnel management, different approaches to their personnel?
Well, you see, Stage 3 does depend, as you... I think it's Stage 2, isn't it, really? I mean, it was the second stage, the Jacob and Isby report. But it does depend on the services, You can't do more than you're doing by evolution of the Ministry of Defence unless you have the services, one service. And the theory was that you would... it would be one defence services, such as the Canadians went for, but of course you would keep the Navy in a blue uniform and so on, but above full colonel, they'd all be in one coloured uniform. The thing is that, I suppose there are two questions you have to ask for. Are these services quite different animals? Do they operate in an quite different environment? When you look at the Gulf War, for instance, the three... There was obviously links, very close links between the Air Force and the Army, but, you know, there were three quite distinct battles going on. There was an air battle, there was a naval operation and so on. The Falklands was a very much a naval operation with an army element. These are very different animals. Do you want to try and make them all the same? And secondly, in a career which, say, I mean, mine lasted 43 years, but most people's careers is shorter than that, 30 or 35 years, where you've got to do certain things in your own bit. You've got to command a battalion if you're a regiment or something, you've got to command a division. Have you really got time to master the warfare of three different things? Because, you see, to be a leader in the Navy, you've really got to have commanded a ship. And to be a leader in the Air Force, you've really got to have flown an aeroplane. And to be a leader on the ground, you've got to have commanded a brigade or a division or whatever it is. Now, have you got time to know your stuff, to do all these things in a normal career? That, I think, is the problem. And I resort to this old philosophy about any organization, that policy always ought to be centralized, but management is usually better devolved. And I don't think it matters whether you are Vickers or ICI or BP or whatever it is. I don't think that is a bad principle. And if you just if you centralize management in the same way as you centralize policy, I think you get a much, much more impersonal and probably more inefficient arrangement.
When you went on to be